Mr. Mammal Show.
Hey, yo, welcome to the Memo Show. It's another hazy day here in LA, but today we are in the studio at Riff Audio Burbank. Raul is a producer engineer, and I've been dying to talk to him. He was actually one of the first people on my list of guests when I was first brainstorming this podcast, and I am so excited to share a story with you. What interested me most was his unwavering commitment and dedication to his craft. I had the pleasure of working with Raul for about 5 years in retail, and every day at lunchtime, he would roll up in the break room with his little Chipotle bowl or his acai bowl, flip open his laptop, put his cans on, and start editing away at a song he's been working on. Every day, he didn't miss a beat. So today I wanted to get a closer glimpse into who he is, what he does, and what fuels that passion to work when he should be on his fucking lunch break. So thanks for taking the time, Raul.
Thank you. I really appreciate you inviting me over.
Well, thank you for inviting me over to your dope-ass studio.
Thank you.
So to start, just tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what your upbringing was like.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that could be its own podcast, to be honest. I had a very interesting upbringing. I was born in Mexico, and then at the age of 5, I moved to Turkey. And then at the age of 8 or 9, I moved to Germany. And then after that, I moved back to Mexico and then migrated to the States.
Shit.
Yeah.
Turkey. It was a lot.
Why Turkey?
My dad's a car engineer, so he was working all over the world. He does the electronics for cars. And Turkey had a big factory at the time, so he was kind of like bootstrapping that from the ground up. But it was kind of scary. Did you ever hear about that massive earthquake that hit there? I was there for that.
Oh, shit.
And it was terrifying.
Nothing like our little California earthquakes, huh?
Well, I've heard there's some pretty gnarly ones, but I have yet to witness one.
Wow. That's pretty crazy. How long were you in Mexico for?
For about 5 years.
Do you remember a lot of it?
Yeah. I mean, it was really cool because I was born in a city called Monterrey. But then I moved to a place called Saltillo. In Saltillo, we had this beautiful, beautiful house. And my dad was really proud. You know, that was what felt like home the most of the time. My dad was really proud. He had a bunch of cars. He had a bunch of dogs. I remember all the dogs that we used to have. And it was a lot of fun. And then when we got the opportunity to move all over the world, things got a little bit more interesting, if you will.
Were you into music your whole life? Is that something that ran in your family or?
No, my dad is really into classic rock, Beatles, Pink Floyd, that whole thing. And I honestly, because he would play it so much, I hated it originally. And it was just every time we get in the car, it's a Pink Floyd song or it's a Beatles song or, you know.
Yeah, we always tend to hate the music our parents listen to.
Exactly. But ironically, as I've been growing and venturing into music, I've come to fall in love with that type of music again, but in my own way, finally, not just kind of forced down your throat type of situation.
Yeah.
But in Germany, my dad was hey, I think you would be a really good drummer. And I was that sounds fucking stupid, dude. why would I want to be a drummer? All I want to do is play video games and eat cake and shit, you know? but he went ahead and bought me a drum set and he got it home. And I just remember being wow, it looks so cool. And I played all day long. And keep in mind, this was in my bedroom. It wasn't a garage type of situation because we didn't have that kind of space in Germany. So I was playing loud as fuck drums in my bedroom and my family's right next door, you know?
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm sure they loved it and hated it at the same time.
Huh? I love you guys. Thank you for dealing with me.
no lessons or anything?
I took lessons and I have this weird history with lessons that and maybe somebody out there can relate. I just become really good friends with instructors and then we kind of forget they're supposed to show me stuff.
Actually teach you.
Yeah. I vividly remember my drum teacher. It was super it was a weird situation. Like, it was a dance studio, and then in the back was this little tiny room with a drum set, and that's where we would practice and stuff. And I remember one of the things I vividly remember is I was trying out for a band, like one of my first punk bands, right? And I was like, hey, like, I don't know what cymbals these are. Like, are these crashes? Are there rides? Are they high? Like, I don't understand. And he's like, well, let's listen to it. And then he started telling me like the timbre of different cymbals. And I was like, there's more cymbals than just like hi-hat, ride, crash. Like, what the fuck, you know? Then we started talking about chinas and splashes. And I was like, dude, what the fuck is happening, you know? But yeah, that his name is Dan. I'll always remember him. He was a great teacher. I'm a asshole and didn't learn.
Yeah, that seems to be the situation with I think a lot of music teachers and music lessons. My guitar teacher when I was, I think, 13 or 14, my mom signed me up for guitar lessons, and it was just some dude, long hair, like washed up metal dude.
Yeah.
His name was Mike. I remember him.
Of course.
And
so was Mike.
It was in the back of like a guitar store, you know, like they did lessons. So I would go in like Tuesdays after school or something, and we'd go in and he'd bring me into this little room in the back, you know, and he would sit there and be like, what do you want to learn how to play?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's like, well, what's your favorite song? And I'm like,
what was the first thing you learned on guitar?
Stone Temple Pilots Plush.
Really?
Yeah. That's the first one.
You see, that's not as embarrassing.
Mine, what was yours?
Mine was Glycerine by Bush.
Oh, yeah. I think that was...
Glycerine.
I still love and play that song. So not too embarrassing, but...
The worst part is I never even heard that song. I was just like, I don't know. What song do you like? He's like, Bush. And I was like, okay, all right, cool.
Yeah. It's a good beat, right?
I don't even remember. I just remember him being like, it's really close to Nirvana. And if I teach you this song, you can play Nirvana. And I was like, sold, bro.
Yeah, that's what they said to me. Like, if you can learn Plush, you basically learn all the chords, and then you can play whatever song you want. So
it's true, kids.
So yeah, Plush was cool. Mike was cool. But I just remember he would just sit me down across from me, and he would just smoke cigarettes.
Oh, whoa.
While we did it. Yeah, it was back then in the 90s, so it wasn't really... I don't know, it wasn't really frowned upon. Yeah. Everybody smoked, so he would just constantly smoke cigarettes while we were playing. But it was basically, he didn't actually teach me anything. He showed me chords, and he's like, here's how to do it, go home and practice. So but nice. What was your earliest inspiration, besides your dad just saying, hey, here's some drums? What inspired you to keep going with music?
So as far as inspiration goes, it's kind of a weird story. Like, when I moved to Germany, obviously, like, I could barely speak English, and I mostly spoke Spanish, right? And one day, I got dropped off at a movie theater to, like, watch a movie with my friends, but I forgot what happened. I think they had to close the movie theater down, or something happened that the showing wasn't there, and this is before cell phones. So I'm a little kid and lost in Germany. And all I remember is anytime we take public transport, we would hear this word Altstadt, which is old town, right? And I was like, okay, I'm just going to get on the train and try my best to get home. Like, I don't really, all I know is like my school and Altstadt.
Yeah.
So I get on this train, and it's getting late at this point. It's dark. It's like nighttime, and I'm fucking terrified at this point. I'm like, I think... what would I be like, 8 or 9? And at one point I vividly remember this group of punk rockers in the corner, and I was fucking terrified. I was like, what? I've never seen anybody like this before, except for like on MTV and shit. Yeah. You know, but even then, it's like Sum 41 versus like street punks from Germany.
Yeah,
very different thing.
Very different.
And I'm looking at them like, being like, if anyone's gonna murder me, it's probably gonna be one of these people. And I vividly remember this chick just comes up to me speaking like full-blown German. And I'm like, dude, I have no idea what you're saying. I'm scared. And I'm just like, Altstadt. And she's like, okay, Altstadt. She's like, do you speak English? I was like, oh, not really.
She's like, well, what do you speak?
Yeah. She's like, where are you from? Well, but eventually she understands that I need to go to Alstadt and that I'm lost, right? Mm-hmm. So this chick just ends up helping me out. And I'm just like, man, how cool was that? Like a complete stranger just
intimidating looking stranger,
exactly.
Too.
So that was kind of the downfall of me getting into heavy music and stuff like that. I just grew connected to that, and MTV was really big at that point. So like Sum 41, Blink 182, Green Day, like the first record I ever bought was Dookie. And then I just, as like my adolescence progressed, I was just like, man, I have a really hard time making friends because I can't relate to anyone because I just traveled all over the world. But the one thing that punk provided for me was a sense of community, a sense of brotherhood, sisterhood, whatever you want to call it. And I just carried that with me up since then, really. When I moved to El Paso, it was very strange. Like, it was very, very, very strange. In Germany, despite what Americans think, Germany is very, very, very aggressively anti-racist. And
yeah,
day one that I arrived in El Paso, I have this weird, like, British Mexican accent, and the first thing that I get called is Mexican Hitler, right? I'm just like, well, welcome to America.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was great. I was really excited because like the longest time I was the only Mexican, right? So I'm like, damn, I want to go to a place that's full of me's, like a bunch of Mexicans. That's gonna be crazy. And then I showed up and everyone was so mean. I was like, oh, okay.
It's fucked up, bro. So lots of pop punk. It's funny because even like our age difference, I'm not quite sure how far apart we are in age, but
how old are you?
43.
I'm 31.
Okay, so that's crazy. Even 10 years apart, Dookie was the first real introduction to punk that I had too.
Yeah.
Because my friends, we were very into grunge. It was like the 90s, so we were super into grunge, industrial. Some of my friends were into like the heavier metal stuff. But for me, you know, it was classic rock and then grunge and then industrial. And then, you know, I rode the techno wave for a little while. But yeah, Dookie was like the first real punk album I heard. From there, I think I kind of started to look into other types of punk.
Totally.
And it wasn't really my thing, but I appreciated it. I liked what it stood for. All the punk kids at my school were awesome, you know, like the grunge kids and the punk kids and the goth kids, you know, like we all got along. Punk shows were super fun. I got into ska, a lot. Those shows were fun. And you're right, the sense of community, you can't beat it, man.
Yeah.
Like it's everybody sticks together, even in the pits, you know what I mean? That's the first thing I noticed was you go to a metal show and you fall in a pit, you're probably going to get hurt, but at a punk show, they'll pick you right up.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And then from there, I think the next step for me was, I remember hearing Outcome the Wolves. That was so huge. And I know like there's that debate, like it's not really punk and it was super like mainstream or whatever. But for me, that album was like, whoa, like I love that album. I listened to that tape like so much. Like I listened to it so much. Like my mom even like learned the songs, you know, she's like, can you put on that Ruby song? I'm like, yeah, bro, let's do this.
Yeah.
As for audio engineering, how did you get into I mean, I'm assuming you played in bands, you were a drummer in bands. How did you get into the audio engineering aspect of the music?
So when I was living in El Paso, Texas, the only studio in El Paso, Texas is this beautiful, like insanely big. It's the biggest recording studio in the world, like physically. Hmm. It's called Sonic Ranch. It's so big that from Studio A to Studio B, you have to drive.
Shit.
Right? So like it's a massive place, but obviously, for punk bands, it's not in the budget, you know, to do something like that. And we're talking like My Chemical Romance has recorded there, like a bunch of huge, huge, huge bands. Mm-hmm. And that was just never my experience. So my bands would go, you know, tap on the shoulder of some dude that's in a bigger band than us and be like, hey, like, we heard you record demos. Like, can you record my band? We're just a shitty punk band. And I remember his name is Norman. He played in a band called Lila. And they were like a very like, imagine like Wednesday 13 type of vibe, but maybe even more mellow. And I remember him like setting up all these mics. And I like as a drummer, you have, you know, 8 to 24 mics or whatever.
Exactly.
So you kind of feel like a badass. You're just like, man, I got all this shit on me. It's going to sound so good, all this stuff. And I remember recording and having the best time. But I remember constantly looking at him and be like, what the fuck is he doing? What is that? What is... I can hear things changing in my headphones, but I don't understand why.
Yeah.
Right? And he gets me back onto the control room, and I'm like, what's that? What's this? What's that? And he's like, dude, you need to chill the fuck out. Like, you're stressing me out. And then eventually, like, after a while, I was like, fuck, like, I want to hear this mix. I want to hear this mix. And when I got the mix back, I was just like, what the fuck? This is amazing! You know, and I was just like, okay, that's it. Like, you just broke the code for me, you know, because it's tough. I think you talked about this a little bit in one of your other episodes where it's like this giant question mark. And then when you start to unveil it, you're like, wait, that's how you do it?
Yeah.
Because originally I thought it was like one mic and somehow it just captures everything beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
When I would start thinking about like the multi-tracking process, I was like, dude, that's too much work. There's no fucking way people are doing that.
Yeah.
And now that I'm doing this, it's exactly that.
Yeah.
And then some, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like a, you know, sharpening the knife, trying to get better and better and better, you know? It's, you know, the first, this is like a awesome, like full circle thing in my life. When I first started recording by myself, I had a Mac because I saved up every fucking penny. Do you remember those black MacBooks?
Mm-hmm. I had the white one.
Hell
that
yeah.
was the first one I started to use.
So when the black
in the box recordings.
Yeah. When the black one came out, I was like, fuck. So I had to get it. Mm-hmm. I got that with GarageBand, right? And they told me the Snowball, the blue Snowball. Do you remember those mics?
Mm-hmm.
So I got one of those and my Mac, and I would just record nonstop. And it sounded nothing like the stuff that Norman did for us, obviously. Yeah. And I was just like, how the fuck does this happen? Like, how do they make it do it? And it was just a bunch of trial and error, buying stuff, realizing that's not it. And then eventually to Riff Audio. But it was just like an obsession from the get.
Yeah, that's kind of like my story. I wanted to know how people did it because I wanted to make my own music. You know, it started with a 4-track, the cassette tape 4-track. And I was the guy that like the bands would be like, hey, can you record our demo? And I'd be like, yeah, let me. I had a little 12-track Mackie mixing board, couple Badass. Microphones, and I just made it work. You know, I just made little demos for people. And then, you know, as that progressed, just upgrade the equipment. You know, and then digital started coming around, you know, and then I got the digital 8-track. And then, you know, when you upgrade like that too, you're like, I could do everything with this, you know, you get totally. A new piece of gear and it's like, oh my God, I can't wait.
What was the piece of gear that like broke the mold for you?
I think when I started to realize that people weren't using outboard gear like that anymore and they were mm-hmm. doing it in the computer.
Right.
It scared the shit out of me because what? I didn't know anything about computers.
Hell yeah.
So I grew up with them, but, you know, we had a family computer in the living room or whatever, but I didn't know how to use it. It was Windows, and I was just like, whatever. Like, what the fuck am I going to use that thing for? I go on AOL once in a while, and, you know, that's it. But all my friends were the ones who were, like, techies, and they were learning the PCs, and they can do the command lines and stuff, and it scared the shit out of me, and that's why... someone was like, oh, if you want to make music and you want to use a computer, you got to get a Mac. And I'm like, fucking Mac. I don't know how to use a Mac. I barely know how to use Windows. Like, what the hell?
Right.
And then so I worked all summer, saved up, bought that white MacBook. And actually, I think the first one was the lampshade iMac that I got the desktop.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I went to the Apple store and I bought a little USB like interface you plug like headphone jacks into. It's input and output. And then, you know, from there, it didn't come with GarageBand, right? So what am I supposed to do to record music? How do I do what I'm doing, this outboard thing with, you know, in the computer? I had no idea. And then I think I was on some forums or whatever, and I saw something called Soundtrack Pro.
Soundtrack Pro.
Do you remember Soundtrack at all?
I don't.
So Soundtrack was Apple software that you use to score films to.
Interesting.
But it had all the stuff like in Logic with, like, you can drop loops in there, you can do multi-tracks, and I just used it for that.
Interesting.
So instead of the movie soundtrack thing, I would plug mics in and use Soundtrack. It was like $200, I think. And it had plugins and it had all that stuff, and I just learned off that. And then eventually they started to add GarageBand automatically to the operating system, and I was like, what do I need GarageBand for? I use Soundtrack. Soundtrack was so powerful. It was like Final Cut mixed with Logic.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy. It was really cool. And that's actually how I got a job at Apple. Was the lead creative was interviewing me, and he's like, oh, what do you use to make music? And I was like, oh, I use Soundtrack Pro. And he's like, the fuck? Like, what? Why are you using Soundtrack Pro for music? And I was like, I didn't have anything else. And he goes, you're hired. That's genius. He was like, that's amazing.
Awesome. I'm surprised I never knew that.
Yeah, it's cool. And I still have soundtrack files and stuff. But
shut up. Really?
Yeah, I don't have the program anymore.
Okay.
No, I have to go into the package and like take all the actual files and dump them in the Logic. But
you should do a video of that. That would be fucking rad.
It looked so nice and it was so smooth. There was like no latency. It was really amazing. And then I discovered Logic and I started to use that more and more because, you know, I think they discontinued Soundtrack Pro after a while. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think once computers came along and the digitalness of everything and not having to buy tapes and there was no degradation to the tapes, I think that was a big thing because I spent a lot of time mixing stuff down.
Yeah.
You know, and every time you try to pass the drums down to a stereo track, it just sounded shittier and shittier, and it was very frustrating. So I think from there, I think that's what really opened it up for me. And then realizing that, you know, I didn't need much. I needed a computer. Mixing board was great to have. Bunch of mics. And then, you know, let your imagination run wild. So.
Take the wheel, baby.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
All right. So tell me about your history of working in studios. And then, you know, what eventually made you decide, like, that was it. You wanted your own studio.
Yeah. So, like, the second I turned 18, I needed to get out of El Paso. It was like, I feel like a lot of people feel this way, and the more I've lived in LA, it seems to be a theme. Like when you're a big fish in a small pond, it's like you get really cocky. And then when you get to a place like LA, you're like, wow, I am the smallest fish here and now I have a chip on my shoulder.
Yeah. You know?
So when I moved out of El Paso, Texas, I went to a school called CRASS. It stood for Conservatory Recording Arts and Sciences. And I learned a lot there. I now would never, ever recommend anybody go to an audio school.
That's so funny because I was thinking about this the other day, and that's the advice I got when I got out of high school. And, you know, I would tell people, hey, I want to get into audio engineering. And, you know, like they always had those ads for like Full Sail and like the back of the magazines.
Totally.
And I was asking about that and people were like, don't do it. You're going to be miserable. You're never going to get studio time. You're going to spend all day sweeping floors. Nobody's going to have time to teach you anything. And it just sounded so dismal and hopeless. And I guess I just wanted to know what your experience was.
I can see where someone would get that, but it's really up to you to make that experience your own. To give you an example, I did maybe over 100 sessions while I was in school. And like the great thing about it is, you know, you book time and you can do whatever you want with it. Like sometimes I would just go in and mix analog because I had the tools, you know. We had these beautiful consoles. One is called an SSL. Another one's called an API. We had a Neotech in there as well, which was the first board I ever learned on. But it was a really cool experience. The reason I'm saying that you don't have to go to those schools anymore is because no one fucking records like that anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I vividly remember we were doing some post-production work, which means, you know, the movie has been recorded and now needs some sound treatment. We were doing some movie stuff, and we synced up two tape machines together, two 24 tracks, using SMPTE time code, and it was fucking complicated, and it took a long time. And the second I graduated from thing, I don't think I saw a tape machine for, like, maybe 3-4 years after that, you know? So it was just a huge disconnect. And honestly, the part of the school that I hated the most was the quote unquote internship. The internship was bullshit. Like, I got to LA, I was staying in a hotel room because we couldn't get an apartment anywhere. Cause you know, if you go to a small town, you know, there's a lobby and there's a little office where you can register to get an apartment and shit. Yeah. Here in LA, it's like, you just got to know somebody that has a place type of thing, or like be super sketchy and go to Craigslist or whatever it is, you know? So I that was very new to me. I didn't know that was even a thing. And eventually, you know, we found a place. We all started interning at different studios. My roommate at the time was working at a place called like Wildfire or something like that for post-production. My other friend was interning in Calabasas with like a really cool producer. And then I got left in the shits with nothing, right? And I was so tired of just waiting and waiting and waiting because I was spending so much money, you know? Like, you're in LA in a hotel room. And I was just like, fuck this. I'm just going to start hitting people up. And I had met someone from the school that worked at Blue Microphones. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, I need an internship. Is there any way I can get in? And they're like, are you kidding me? Absolutely. Come on in. And I would drive from Burbank to Westlake Village every single day for maybe about 4 or 5 years. And but it was cool, man. Like, I built a lot of the pro Blue microphones. Like, that guy I built, these headphones I helped design. Like, I learned lot there. But it was tough because it's like, I don't want to be a I don't want to be a master microphone builder. I want to make music, you know? And eventually I was just like, dude, I came to LA to do music, not to build mics, right? And so I was like trying to hit up studios to like intern at. And finally someone was like, cool, like, I'll give you a shot. And my first studio I worked at was called Palmquist. Palmquist is a really, really cool studio. Like, it's probably one of the coolest studios I've ever worked at, just because it's a vibe, and what you get is exactly what you get, right? You walk in, it's got like this crutch velvet everywhere. It's like super 70s style, this vintage Ludwig kit, this badass Trident console. And, you know, it wasn't super, super fancy, but it was rad. It was such a fucking vibe. And I just remember the smell of coffee and crushed velvet every single day. And I interned there for a very long time, but interning, you're not getting paid.
Yeah.
You know, so eventually I ran out of money and had to get a job at Guitar Center. And that went to shit real quick.
Well, how the hell did you survive? You said you did 5 years at Blue as an intern, or you got a job?
I did get a job right after my school internship, which is like 2 months or something like that. So I was like a technician. Like, once I started building the pro mics and stuff, at first they were just making me QC stuff, like all the Yeti mics and the Blue Snowballs. Mm-hmm. I just made sure that they sounded okay. And then eventually I learned to solder and like build and tune diaphragms. And man, it was intense.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah.
So then Guitar Center, we all know what it's like working at retail music places.
It was rough. It was very rough. I actually got fired from there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That was the only job I've ever been fired from. And the best part is I started working at Apple at that point already. So I came in one day and they're like, hey, you're 6 hours late. And I was like, yes, and what? Because I still would sell people under the table. And the way Guitar Center works is a fucking horrible corporation. But like, you get 3% commission if your sales per hour are X amount. So the longer you work there, the less money you make.
That sounds awful.
It's super smart, guys.
Oh my God. Sounds awful.
Yeah.
You worked... Where'd you say you worked at another studio?
Yeah, so I worked at Palmquist for a while, and I did the biggest record I did there was a band called Bad Sons. And, well, there's two big records. The one is a band called Chon, and then the other one is called Bad Sons.
Oh, I heard them on your playlist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, love those bands to death, to death, to death. And they, like, helped me get a lot of my business. And then eventually I ran out of money again and got the job at Apple, right? It was interesting because at that time, Bad Sons was the cover of iTunes. So whenever you went to like iTunes, mm-hmm. right? You know how they have the splash page, that banner on the top on a computer or your phone even?
Yeah, like the store, you mean? iTunes store? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were the headline.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so like I would go in and to the Apple store and be like, oh my God. They would play the song at the store. And I was like, are people going to know it's me or whatever? And I'm like, no, I'm just being a fucking idiot. No one gives a shit who the producer or engineers are on anything.
You know? I know. That's changing, though. Like, a lot of people know engineers and producers nowadays, which is...
Man, I want to agree with you so bad because I want that more than anything in the world. But and my buddy just won a Grammy. He didn't even know he won a Grammy.
We're still in the background, and we still, you know, people don't realize how much we contribute to records as producers and engineers. But I think the world is starting to see, especially with like Taylor Swift, like,
yeah,
everybody knows who her producer is going to be and what the album is going to sound like, depending on what producer that she has,
yeah.
And like who she's writing songs with. So I'd like to think that people are starting to give producers and engineers more credit, the credit that they deserve nowadays. Yeah, so
I really hope so. There's an app that I've really enjoyed. I honestly like genuinely thought it was a scam at first, and then I tried it just to see what the fuss was about and just ended up falling in love with it. Check it out. It's called Muso.ai, and essentially it's this AI that goes through all the catalog of Spotify specifically, mm-hmm. and finds credits for you. Right. Oh. And then you can also add your own credits being like, hey, I worked on this. Because if you look right now, even on like Apple Music or Spotify, if you tap the like view credits thing, mm-hmm. it's empty. Right.
Yeah.
So with Muso, you can start populating at least some type of database. But it's rad, man. Like being able to like, you know, like you said, I've been hustling and hustling and hustling for years. And there's a lot of times I feel like every creator feels like there's like, I have nothing to show for.
Yeah.
But something like this, it's, you know, I looked at my number like a few weeks ago and we're at like 6 million streams.
Nice.
Something like that. And I was just like, fuck, okay. I do have some, like, cool. Okay. Yeah. I have done something, you know?
Yeah.
So shout out to Muso. Love those guys.
Nice. Obviously you were still working on projects during your lunch break.
Yeah.
And then I know there was whispers of, Riff's going to open his own studio. Riff's going to do this. Riff's going to do that. And then COVID happened, right?
I didn't know that was a
thing. What?
I didn't know that was a thing. That's awesome.
Cool. Well, but then COVID happened. And I think that's where you really kicked it into high gear because you were like, shh, I'm going to take advantage of this time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like when I first started at Apple, it was pretty basic, you know, just working retail. And eventually I found this studio in Whittier, California, which is pretty far for Burbank.
Yeah.
Where a bunch of dudes were like, hey, we want to make a studio. And because there were so many people involved, the overhead was relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in there, like, just super aggressively doing sessions. And, like, I would literally go to work at Apple, you know, I think, what's closing time? Like 10?
Yeah, like if you were lucky, you'd get out of there at 9:30.
Yeah, so like let's say from 9:30, I would get to the studio around 10, 10:30, work till like 4 in the morning, and then come back home and then just do it all again every single day for years. And then it came to a point with my co-owners that, I was funding a lot of the gear and stuff, and it felt really disconnected because no one cared as much as I do.
Yeah.
And I was just like, all right, guys, this is not working out. I'm out. I'm sorry, but I'm out. And then there's another producer called Kyle Black. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's an incredible engineer producer. He did stuff for State Champs, Comeback Kid, Pierce the Veil, Paramore, Newfound Glory,
Okay.
The works, right?
Yeah.
And I started working with him for a while, and to the point where I was renting out Studio B from him at his studio called West Alley in Van Nuys. So I was working at Apple doing that, and then COVID hit and all business just went to shit, right?
Yeah, you couldn't really do it the way that you used to do it.
Exactly. So I saw this as an opportunity for me, you know, to go into West Alley and just try to dial in my sound, my things. And we, you know, we were super careful. We would COVID test everybody before coming into the premises. We had a whole like situation. We had gloves at all times. We had masks at all times. So we were trying to be as safe as possible. But unfortunately, the way government is set up, especially in California, like all the creatives were fucked. They were, we were just left to fend for ourselves. It's not like Apple where we were getting a little extra cash here and there when it was COVID. Like all the creatives were just stopped full blown, especially for the bands that were touring. They were all freaking out because now touring stopped altogether.
That's their main source of income.
Exactly. We just saw it as a big opportunity to like kind of hone in the sound and try to figure things out that have been pending, as every studio has a million things pending. And eventually, when Kyle got back, we had a little bit of a disagreement about money wise, just because a fair market value for the studio I was renting versus what I thought it was worth wasn't aligning. And I was like, you know what, dude, I'm sick of like co-owning a studio or working with somebody.
Yeah,
I just want to do my own thing. Like, it's time. I started looking around, and dude, LA is so expensive. Like, for a room, even this, just this size, not even the control room, we're talking 25-3 grand a month with no treatment. And I was just like, dude, fuck this. Like, why am I gonna spend, you know, $1,000 to $2,000 for rent and that on top?
Yeah.
So I'm paying $4,000 just renting. It's like, fuck that. We found a house, pulled the trigger, immediately started building out, like immediately. And now, dude, I could not be happier. This place is incredible.
This is like, if you asked me when I was like 16, like what I wanted my studio to look like or be like,
yeah,
this is it.
Yeah.
This is so crazy. Like, this is, that's why I'm so excited for you and happy for you, because I, you know, I had that same vision and that same dream when I was a kid, and seeing someone do it is freaking awesome. This place is amazing, man.
Yeah, no, like John Brandt, who designed the studio, just did an incredible job. Like, he even told me it from the get. He's like, dude, I don't think this is a good idea. And I was just like, dude, I don't care.
I don't care.
Yeah, like, I just, I got to do it. And I feel so passionate about it. Like, I'll figure it out. You know, that's the thing with creatives. You know, you have to figure it out. So we did the build. It came out great. Thank you to Nightback Builds for helping me build this place out, because without them, dude, I felt so bad. They're the best people in the world. They're the people that actually constructed everything and did all the treatment and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still working at Apple, so I would get a phone call from them while I'm trying to teach a class, right? And be like, hey, like, I gotta step out, and then go into those like the rolling racks or whatever, and just have these, they're like, hey, like, the walls are falling. Like, we need to put like a sheer wall. I was like, whatever it takes, just make it happen.
Just do it.
So I was super stressed. I'm sorry if I was an asshole around that time.
That's so awesome, man.
I got to send you a video of that, because it's crazy.
Yes, please do. Cool. So what does it look like when someone books time with you?
Yeah. So if for those of you that might not know, there's a couple things that we offer here. One is production. So when you ask for a producer, it means that you're going from point A to point B, right? We're overseeing the whole process. So your band comes in with usually a song, right, that I tell them sucks. And then we have to redo the structure of the song or the chord progressions of the song, the melody of the song, whatever it is. And then we work together to get something that's really fucking badass. Then we book another day for tracking. Then tracking happens, which is when we actually play all the instruments. You know, drums get recorded, bass gets recorded, guitars get recorded, sometimes piano, sometimes percussion, vocals, X, Y, and Z. Then we also offer mixing. mixing is when you get the multi-track and you make it sound damn good. Mm-hmm. And we don't really offer mastering. We will do mastering for people just because your budgets are tighter now than ever.
Yeah, mastering was the most expensive part of any record I've ever made with a band.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was like studio time was great, you know, like it was manageable, but then we had to find someone to master it.
Right.
And it was like, it always seemed like the biggest chunk of cash for
yeah.
me because the studios are built
yeah.
for recording or they're built for mastering.
Yes.
So is that something that you were aiming to do is kind of have a mastering studio too?
No, I say we do full mastering because mastering is its own art form.
Yeah.
You know, I really genuinely in my heart of hearts feel that like the mastering engineers are the masters of engineering
yeah.
because they're talking about 1.5 dBs.
When it was just always like, so intimidating to me when yeah. we talk about mastering.
Every single artist I've ever had do a proper master comes back to me is like, hey, I don't know what I'm supposed to be listening for.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this sounds amazing. Go for it. You know? But yeah, like if you want to push your record just over the top, that extra 5-10% or whatever, get a proper master.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's true.
It's incredible. But yeah, that's what we offer here at Riff Audio. We also do like video and all that stuff. The whole room has SDI. So if you bring in fancy ass cameras, it all can run to the computer, run multiple video channels, run multiple audio channels. It's pretty badass.
Nice. That sounds awesome. As a producer, what are some different ways that you use to get the best performances out of an artist? Because you said, like, usually they come to you with an idea or a demo and you're like, this is trash, let's fix it.
Mm-hmm.
When people are laying down tracks, what are some tricks that you use to, and you don't have to give away your tricks of the trade, but...
I'm an open book.
Please. Okay. But what are some ways that you have found that really get the best performance out of people?
Feel like... I'll give you like a artsy answer and I'll give you a technical answer. The artsy answer I would say is like communication and being vulnerable with one another. Music is tough, you know, because at least with video or anything that's visual, especially with like the whole TikTok thing that's going on around right now, it's really easy to hide over a mask. But with music, there is no mask. It's just lyrics and chord progressions, really, and a beat, right? So it's a matter of telling a story and being real about it and really finding the communication, you know? Like, there's a difference between saying I'm sad, right, and I'm sad because my dog died or whatever it might be, right? Those are two very different situations. And I think it's really important, especially with nowadays, with everything being so fast and instant, to understand where the human connection needs to be, right? I am producing a record right now for a band called Nice, and it's been such a beautiful thing to see them grow. We started recording this record in August of last year, and we maybe have 2 or 3 more songs to go, but for the songs then till now, they're just, dude, it sounds like a different fucking band, and they're being deeper and deeper each time, which is just exciting to watch, honestly.
Yeah.
And then as far as like a technical answer, one thing I've been really getting into is reamping. So in audio, there's a way to record a guitar directly into the computer, right? Which means there's no distortion. It's just a clean guitar,
mm-hmm.
right? And then reamping means you grab that clean guitar and you push it through some amplifiers. I did a record for a band called Self Neglect. And literally the chorus has different guitar tone than the verse, then the pre-chorus, then this and that and this. And reamping made that awesome because they can just focus on performing really well.
Yeah.
And then I can figure out all the tone stuff after the fact. You know?
Pretty sick.
It's amazing. It's amazing because when you're a guitarist, you're just like, okay, I have one amp, one cab, and I'm going to make it work.
Yeah.
When you're reamping, you have every cab. You have every head.
You can experiment.
You can do whatever the fuck you want.
That's dope.
And it's fun. It's so much fun.
So you just record it clean and then you just run it through, so...
Yep.
Huh.
And one thing I learned on the Chon record, when they first sent me the demo, I was like, I think they probably just didn't know how to add distortion on a computer. But no, they play clean on purpose. And I asked them why. And they're like, because it... if you put distortion, reverb, or anything on your guitars, it hides your mistakes. And I was like, damn, that's like a statement, right? Hmm. When you do DI, it's just a guitar.
Yeah.
You can hear everything. You can't, if you're out of tune, if you're out of time, if the chords are not working together, if the lead is clashing with the vocal melody, whatever it is, you can hear it immediately, right? With distortion, you're like, fuck, but that tone sounds so good.
Sounds good.
Push, go through it. Nah. Like, take your time, make sure it's all working together. If it doesn't work clean, it's not going to work distorted.
Yeah. A couple more. Have you ever challenged an artist on their vision?
Yes.
Or like butted heads with someone artistically in the studio? And what was the result of that? What was the outcome?
All of the above. I mean, there's some artists that I've been like, wow, I really like your music. We should make a record together. And then when I meet them, I'm like, wow, I don't like you as a person. And I don't think this is going to work out, you know? Or a lot of the times it's like, well, I'm the artist, so like, I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm like, all right, cool. Peace. You know, like, we don't vibe well. We don't vibe well, and we never will, you know? But there's sometimes that people will listen. And if you get someone that's willing to listen to you and try those ideas, it makes for a really magical moment. Like, again, that band Nice has been a great example of that. They've elevated themselves so fucking much, you know? And another band that I could probably mention is a band called Chain Wolf, you know? Like, we started recording with like at the rehearsal space, you know? And now we're recording here, and it's really elevated their performances and their vision for what is the band and why it should not sound like somebody else, but it should sound like the band itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of bands are like, I want to sound like X Band or Metallica or some shit.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, you know why Metallica got the way they are? It's because the whole time they were just like, I want to be Metallica. I don't want to be anybody else but Metallica.
Yeah, it takes time to find who you are first, you know? What's it like working with some of your, like, heroes and your idols, you know, who are literal, like, punk idols, as opposed to artists who are just, like, getting started?
I'm allowed to talk about one of those situations, maybe two. So we started working with a band called Circle Jerks. And, like, I in El Paso, I remember being in the bus and just being pissed at the fucking world, listening to Circle Jerks and just being like, this is the only thing that's getting me through today.
Yeah.
And Tim Armstrong calls me. He's like, hey, you want to do the next Circle Jerk record with me? And I was like, shut the fuck up. So we were in the studio a week ago for 4 weeks straight with Circle Jerks, just making a banger ass record that I'm really excited to show everybody.
That's I saw that on your Instagram. Yeah. That's so awesome, dude.
Another one was it's a band called Infectious Grooves. I don't know if you've heard of them before.
I think I have.
But, dude, the lineup is crazy. It's Jay Weinberg, ex-member of Slipknot. It's Robert Trujillo from Metallica. It's Dave Kushner from Danzig. It's Adam from Exel. And then it's the front person, Mike Muir, and Dave Pleasant from Suicidal Tendencies. And the producer on that is Paul, who produced Rush. So,
what the fuck?
Yeah, man, it's been a crazy couple months for sure. Like I remember the drummer of Circle Jerks now is a guy called Joey Castillo, and Joey, it turns out, I didn't know this after looking him up, after working with him, because he's just a monster drummer. Like, dude, you're in the room with him, it sounds like you're sitting next to a Harley. He hits so fucking hard, it's insane. But He was the drummer of Queens of the Stone Age for like 11 years.
Nice.
And I remember the first time I ever heard drums that I was like, wow, this sounds good, was Queens of the Stone Age Little Sister. I just remember that like temple block thing and then like the drum beat coming in. I was like, whoa, what is this?
Yeah, all their stuff is like monstrous.
It was Joey. He's just such a fucking great drummer. Jay Weinberg is a fucking phenomenal drummer. It's been crazy, man.
And you have these guys in here, or you go to a different studio?
No. So Tim Armstrong owns a studio in Silver Lake called The Boat, which was a Christian radio studio originally. But they have this board called a Neve 8028, And the only ones that I know of that exist is Dave Grohl's from Sound City.
Sound City, yeah.
Tim Armstrong's At the Boat and Stevie Wonder's.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like an
analog board, right?
Yeah, like, it's unfair. Like, everything you put on it just sounds amazing right away.
Oh, crap. I'm sure, man. That's nuts, dude.
Yeah.
So you got a busy couple years, huh? Those are all projects you're working on?
Yeah, those are current in the can projects right now. And that's just a fraction of, that's not including the Riff Audio stuff.
For sure, I would love to push the Nice record. That one's going to be huge. Like, everyone's really, really excited about that project. The Circle Jerks one I can talk about for sure. So that's going to be a massive project as well. I'm working with another band called Knuckleheads, who's doing a documentary with, like, there's this, I don't even know what to call it, like a meme page, I guess. But it's called Foo's Gone Wild.
Oh, I love that.
I love Foo's. I love them. Half of my personality is, but Foo's Gone Wild is doing a documentary with Knuckleheads.
Nice.
So I'm really excited with that project as well. My babies, these guys, dude, the drummer's 16 and is probably one of the best drummers ever. Like, insane. And like, all the musicians are incredible. They're called New Aesthetic from San Diego. They're like more in the pop punk vein.
Okay.
But man, they're young. They're young and they're going to blow the fuck up.
My sister probably knows who they are. She's got her finger on the pulse of all the stuff in San Diego.
Beautiful.
I'll ask her.
Beautiful.
That's dope, dude.
I'm about to start a record with a band called Tough Front. I have you know, the band Converge? They're like a heavy hardcore type of band. They're similar sounding to Converge. They're called Mourn. I want to get more booked. So if people are looking, hit us up. We run this place as a collective, just so you know as well. That means that we all get split evenly. So that means that if I'm out of the budget for an artist, there's a whole community of awesome engineers part of this collective that I can give to another engineer if the budget's not there. So let's say if a band is here and they're like, we only have $500 to do a record. Cool. I'm going to give it to the next up and coming engineer because they deserve that. And that's what it's all about. I made this place not for me and not for the bands. I made this place to be a really humble community that can help each other out and finally start making some type of money out of music.
Because that's fucking incredible, dude.
That's what it's all about, dude. That's what it's all about. I seriously hate how the music industry is run, and it's a matter of people taking chances and changing that now.
That's incredible, man. Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you, dude. This was fun.
Awesome.
We gotta do this again. This was cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dude, my pleasure. This was awesome. This was dope.
Well, there you have it, folks. Raul from Riff Audio in Burbank. Bro, that interview was awesome. Thanks for doing that. Once again, visit me at THEEMEMOSHOW on Instagram. Give me a follow. I have a YouTube, at The Memo Show. Subscribe to that. I know this episode was a little late. Sorry. My dad came over from the East Coast. I had to entertain, so family comes first, always, and plus, it's going to make for a good podcast. Hint, hint. Maybe do a little family history. But anyway, thank you for listening. I appreciate you. Leave a review in the podcast app for me. Those help tremendously. And see you in a couple weeks. Thanks.